Every day in Gotham City brings new surprises, but this day is going to top them all. Although it begins none too differently, just wait. Just wait.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. I don't say that often enough. Today we are going to engage in a broad conversation about pulp, new pulp, comics, and more with our guest, Jim Beard. Welcome aboard the show, Jim.
Hey, great to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on.
No problem. A
native Toledoan, I guess I'm saying that right.
Yep.
Jim was introduced to comic books at an early age by his father, who passed on to him a love for the medium and the pulp characters who preceded it. After decades of reading, collecting, and dissecting comics, Jim became a published writer when he sold a story to DC Comics in 2002. Since that time, he's written official Star Wars and Ghostbusters comic stories and contributed articles and essays to several volumes of comic book history. Hey, I have two. His work includes Gotham City 14 Miles, which is a great title, a book of essays on the 1966 Batman TV series. Sergeant Janus Spiritbreaker, a collection of pulp ghost stories featuring his own Edwardian occult detective. Captain Action, Riddle of the Glowing Men, the first pulp prose novel based on the classic 1960s action figure. And Monster Earth, a shared world anthology of giant monster tales. Currently, Jim has crossed over to the other side of the aisle and provides regular content for Marvel.com, the official Marvel Comics website, which has been around almost as long as AvengersAssemble.net, is a regular columnist for the Toledo Free Press, and has new and forthcoming comic and prose work from Blue Water, Tomorrows, Airship 27, and Prose. Please
visit and White Rocket.
And White Rocket, that is correct, yes. The only one of those I'm not fairly familiar with is Blue Water. I know who they are and what they do, but I think the Tomorrow's owner is an Auburn guy like me, and I've talked with his people a little bit in the past, and of course Airship and Prose are old hands around here, and White Rocket, of course. So please visit Jim at SGT Janus, like Sergeant Janus, sgtjanus.blogspot.com. And on Facebook at facebook.com/TheBeard, Jim Beard. What an interesting name there. Okay. Well, Jim, all right, so you have a lot going on and a lot in your past, and I just kind of want to dig around through this a little bit. I'm going to get my metal detector and my little spade, and we're going to kind of dig around a little bit and see what we can dig up.
I'm a huge metal detector fan.
Well, that's great.
That's what I want for my 50th birthday.
How interesting I should happen to randomly pick that metaphor then. Okay,
yeah.
Well. All right, so we're going to talk about the stuff that you're doing now, the stuff coming up in the future. We're going to talk about some stuff in general. But first, I kind of want to dig around your biography a little bit. So,
okay.
All right, so let's start at the very beginning, because usually the first question I give guests is sort of how did you get involved or how did you come to whatever it is we're talking about. But our topic today is really just sort of the things that you and I both really enjoy in the pulp and new pulp and comics world. So when you say that you were first introduced to comics in early age, what was it? Was it Marvel? Was it DC? Was it something else? And what was the impact on you?
You know, comic books were always sitting around my house when I grew up. I have an older brother and sister, and they had a few comics of their own. So, you know, they were always sitting around. And my dad was a huge comic book fan back in the 40s and 50s, and there were still a few of those comics, actually, laying around the house. But then my dad started buying them for me specifically.
Mm-hmm.
My older brother and sister weren't too, I almost said too literate, but they started pursuing other things. I was much more cerebral. You know, my dad has two sides to him. He has a cerebral side and he has a sports minded side. And I didn't get the sports gene at all. So, you know, he picked up on the fact that I loved reading and I love creating and all of that. So he started buying me comics. And, you know, he started off with getting me the usual things, you know, Walt Disney comics or the Harvey stuff, Casper. And I'm heading down that road now with trying to get back some of those old funny comics. But
mm-hmm.
Then late 72, early 73, he started buying me superhero comics, DC, a little bit of Marvel, and you know, the die was cast at that point. You know, I was just absolutely and utterly hooked on
yep.
those things, and you know, the rest is history.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very similar to my own story. Now, I a couple of things you said I want to follow up on. You're talking about that sports and comics. I'm the same way as your dad. It's pretty well known. I have two podcasts, one about
yeah.
sports, one about pop culture, right? And it's
yeah.
interesting. It seems like some people can kind of, you know, put a foot in each world, and some just really don't want to, they're in one and don't want to go in the other. And I wonder why that is. That's just interesting.
Yeah, you know, like I said, I felt like I didn't get the sports gene. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's funny, and you know, I respect sports fans because I think there's a lot of threads between, you know, how sports fans' brains work and
mm-hmm.
how comic book or other genre fans' brains work. But
yeah.
you know, it's funny for me. It just leaves me cold. I'm not a competitive person. That might have something to do with it. And I'm not a terribly physical, you know, person as far as, when I was a kid, if I went outside, it was to haul my comic book collection out onto the porch, you know,
awesome.
I mean, I ran around, I guess, as much as, you know, other kids and got my knees dirty, but, you know, when it came to my dad saying, hey, let's go out in the back and throw the old baseball around or football around, that was my brother.
Mm-hmm.
That was not me at all, you know.
Right.
It was more like, hey, Dad, can we haul some, you know, pencils and paper and crayons out on the you know, table out back and draw, you know,
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's kind of weird because, like I said, my whole family, very sports-minded, and then there's me, you know.
Yeah, I totally get that. I can, you know, back in the day, I would go to Dragon Con and put on a costume and run around, and then I'd put on my Auburn costume, basically, right, and go to a football game. And I think you're right. There are a lot of common threads. In both cases, you're obsessing over something. You're dressing
yep.
a certain way because of it. And
yeah.
you're probably going on far too long about it to people who are around you who don't care in both cases, right?
Right. Yeah, obsession is the key word there. I mean, you know, jokes aside, it does become an obsession.
Yeah.
But you know, there's also the collecting mentality that,
mm-hmm.
that's wrapped up in all of that. Being a fan of personalities is all wrapped up in that also. You know, the following of, well, let's say statistics and things like that. I mean, it's really, really connective. There's so much connective tissue there that I'm surprised there's not more dual fans, or if there is, maybe the sports fans are not talking about their comic book collection.
Yeah, and that may very well be it. Yeah, he may
yeah.
have really done it. Another thing you said I want to touch on real quick, you're talking about those early funny comics. I think a lot of us started out with, you know, with those early ones. What were the early? Do you still remember some of them that you had?
Yeah, and like I said, my nerdness came to the forefront just the other day. I'm looking at it right now. I made a spreadsheet of the Gold Key and Harvey comics that I had when I was little, mm-hmm. and I don't have any more. This is weird. I have 99% of the comics that I've ever had owned.
Wow.
From my entire life. But I have this weird, it's about 45 to 50 comics that I no longer own, and my memories of them are coming back now. You know, it's almost like I had them wiped from my memory, and I've started looking at covers on comics.org. And I'm going, had that one. had that one.
Yeah.
And so here I made this spreadsheet because it's my new goal. My new obsession is to, you know, one day get these back. And I just got three of them. I was at a convention, got one. I just got another one through eBay, a Walt Disney Comics Digest that I had almost completely and utterly forgotten.
Wow.
And the moment I took it out of the package, it was literally like an old friend.
Right,
like,
right.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Look at this Matchbox, you know, ad that's on the back cover. I love that ad. How could I ever have forgotten that? So a lot of Caspers. I love Casper and that whole Enchanted Forest universe of his. Loved all of that stuff. Not as much Disney, you know, the ducks and the mouse and all that, but some of that. And then there's Choo Choo Charlie number one, which I found out the value on is very high. There was only ever one issue.
I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, it's Choo Choo Charlie was the character from Good and Plenty, the candy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was their spokes character.
Their spokes candy.
Right. He had a little locomotive, and he was, you know, a boy, but he was a conductor, and he was Choo Choo Charlie. Well, they made a comic. You know, Gold Key made a comic out of everything. And it was one issue, and I had it, loved it. Gone. Have no idea whatever happened to it.
Huh.
But now I'm looking it up and like the values on this, even in rough shape, you know, this thing can be 25, 30, 35, 40 bucks. I'm like, ooh, ouch.
But no, I know exactly what you mean when you find a comic or something that you had years and years and years ago, and it just all comes back to you suddenly. And like you said, even the ads, because when you're a little kid, you study everything closely. So if there was an ad, you study the ad closely. You know, nowadays, if I ever read a comic book and it's few and far between anymore, when I come across the ad, I'm like, oh, it's an ad. I just blow right past it. But we would spend as much time studying the ads back then as the rest of the comics sometimes.
And I took it one step further, and then I drew the ads that I was seeing. There were Mego ads, you know, Mego action figures back in the day. I remember the ad that came out when they introduced the Hulk and the Falcon action figures from Mego's, and I sat and drew those pictures over and over and over again. It was the same way with this Matchbox ad, because it's drawn, you know, no photos. It's actually drawn like a comic strip.
Yeah.
And just, you know, obsessed over that. But when superheroes came along, that just almost completely wiped out my interest in the funny books.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that Batman TV series, you know, I think I actually probably was introduced to Batman through that show first before the comics, or it might have been at the almost exact same time. So, you know, I've said this to a lot of people and I joke about it, but it's absolutely true. That show made me the comic fan, the genre fan, whatever you want to call it, that I am today. That's my touchstone, I guess, to everything.
Yeah, well, we all have, you know, something that's sort of like that. For me, it was a kind of a combination of the Avengers comics and then Star Wars, both in 1977. I was thinking back. I think that I can remember having, you know, like some Archie comics, just whatever random things people would give me when I was little. I remember having a couple of Uncle Scrooge and the you know, Huey, Dewey, and Louie. And I can definitely remember having several issues of Richie Rich. And I can remember being fascinated by Richie Rich right up until the point. And at one point, I think my brother had a Justice League issue. And this was probably 1975, somewhere in there when I was pretty little.
Yeah.
And I remember reading the Justice League issue and thinking, well, that was okay. And in fact, it was even like a Justice League, Justice Society big crossover. And I was like, well, that was okay, but I don't know, just something
that's
about
okay.
It. Yeah, I'll go back to Richie Rich. I'm not really digging this Justice League thing.
Wow.
And then somebody gave me Avengers 162,
okay.
And I remember immediately going to my grandmother and saying, if you're going to the store, could you look for anything that says Avengers on it? Just get that. And I think she came back with that What If issue where everybody wears armor for the Avengers,
and she
came back with a Marvel triple action. And I remember reading both of them and thinking, well, this isn't quite the same. The art's not the same, and this is kind of old-fashioned, this reprint thing, whatever. I didn't know what that was. So I was just very fortunate to come along at a time when Jim Shooter and George Perez were really in their golden period of writing the Avengers. And, you know,
See, I came along a little bit before that, and I'm glad you mentioned the reprints, because it was a combination of the reprints that DC was just flooding at that point, and my dad and his interests as a child that really cemented my interest in things, I call it things that came before me, you know,
mm-hmm.
all capital letters are things that came before me.
Yeah.
And that includes the pulp characters, you know, if I didn't have somebody like my dad really kind of sitting me down and telling me about the Shadow or making me, you know, watch old Sherlock Holmes movies on TV, you know, with Basil Rathbone or all the other different things, and those reprints where you got a DC 100-page Super Spectacular, which was my first superhero comic, a Batman one,
mm-hmm.
that had, you didn't just get, you know, a 70s, an early 70s story, you got a 60s, a 50s, a 40s, and maybe even a 30s story. And that's how I think I gained an appreciation of all of that, because it was that comparing and contrasting. And yeah, some of the older stuff was cruder, you could tell that, but there was something about it, and I gained an appreciation for the Justice Society of America.
Mm-hmm.
And other than Batman, that's my one of my passions in comic book history is the Justice Society. I used to run a Yahoo group or club back when they had clubs before groups. A Yahoo club for the Justice Society, and at one point it was the largest comic book club on Yahoo.
Wow.
Called the JSA Appreciation Association. And, you know, we had the writers and the artists of the actual comics in there and everything. So that was a real highlight of my fandom.
That's so funny, because that's pretty much how I got my start, was doing exactly the same thing with the Avengers, you know. And
you got those books and everything.
But we, over the years in our Yahoo group, and before that we had an email group that was just run privately off of its own server. We had, you know, we've had Kurt Busiek and Tom Brevoort and George Perez and Tom Smith and all these different guys in and out over the years, you know. So and the group has grown and shrunk. Been around for like 15, 17, 18 years now. It's hard to imagine that the internet's that old now.
Yeah.
But and that we are.
Yeah.
You mentioned a minute ago Gold Key, and that's a topic that we probably ought to do a show about just by itself at some point in the future, because Gold Key
you do it, and I want in on that one.
I mean, they really did. I have to have time to prepare and everything. Just off the top of my head, though, when you mention it, I'm thinking, man, they really did do comics about just about everything. They're you know, it's funny, they're kind of almost forgotten in a way, if they're not completely forgotten, and yet they were an integral part of the history of comic books.
Absolutely. You know, not only are they, you know, the house of licenses,
mm-hmm.
but their original characters create this kind of sub-tier for me, you know, as much as I loved Batman and the Justice League and Justice Society and the Avengers and the Fantastic Four and all of that, Then there was the Magnus Robot Fighter.
Oh, yeah.
Turok, Son of Stone.
Mm-hmm.
All of that stuff. There's a comic that they had called UFO Flying Saucers that had just... so much of Sergeant Janus in the first book is based on stuff from UFO Flying Saucers. I know that sounds weird, but it's true.
Oh, yeah.
All that original stuff that they did,
mm-hmm.
is just incredible. Especially with the creators, you know, that Russ Manning's Magnet,
yeah.
is just incredible. Just blows me away every time. Space Family Robinson. All that stuff blows me away when I go back through it today. And I thought, why didn't I concentrate more on that when I was little? But I think that the DC and Marvel stuff just gobsmacked me so hard, you know, that I concentrated, you know, more on that. I love early Marvels because my dad bought me mostly DC, but I used to go into the drugstore and look at the spinner rack, and interspersed would be all these Marvels, and they always seemed like something I wasn't supposed to be looking at. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, here was the Super Friends comic book from DC, you know, and then here was Son of Satan, Werewolf by Night,
yeah.
Defenders,
hey,
you know,
and
it's like,
comics.
You know, this subversive stuff, and you know, the covers were always more grimy and gritty, you know, and you kind of like looked over your shoulder and kind of paged through them a little bit, you know, Shauna, She-Devil, like, should I be looking at this? I had the pleasure of talking to Walt Simonson about a month ago about something he was doing for Marvel, and in the middle of it, he kept bringing up Manhunter, and it's like, it was an interview for Marvel.com, and I'm officially supposed to swing him back to Marvel, you know, but he's talking about Manhunter, and I said, you know what, I said, this won't go into this Marvel.com interview, but I just have to stop here for a moment and fans, you know, fan gush at you. I said, that Manhunter series just knocked me for a loop. I said, in the middle of all the nice DC stuff, here came Manhunter. And that was just like I thought of it as the Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
Like Marvel stuff. And I said to him, I said, oh my God, you know, that first installment of that, I said, I really was not sure that I wasn't going to have that book taken away from me if my dad or my mom, I said, he goes, yeah, a lot of people died in that, didn't they? And I said, yeah, you know, I said, they're getting shot and they're falling off of ledges and slamming onto the ground. And I said, and the women, you know, and just the way it was drawn, I said, that was some subversive stuff there for the young brain, you know, that I had.
Sure. That's great. I just love the idea of like the guy that runs the shop coming over and shooing you away from the Marvel section. Go back over to that wholesome DC stuff, young man, before it rots your brain. Oh no.
And then Marvel, or and then DC turned subversive. So you know, I was stuck.
Yeah, and you know, Gold Key. Speaking of them again, we have to do a Gold Key and Charlton show because those two.
Yeah.
They really.
I didn't grow up with Charlton that I'm aware of. If I did, then there was some oddball things. But I like it now, but I didn't really know it back in the day.
Well, they were both doing, like you said, a lot of licensed stuff and a lot of oddball stuff. And so they were, they were, you know, they're like, you know, if Marvel and DC are chocolate and vanilla, you know, Charlton and Gold Key are never going to be your favorite flavors. But they're more like pistachio and Rocky Road or something. But it was nice to sprinkle a few in here and there, you know. So
good analogy. Yeah, well, pistachio, that's perfect.
Yeah, well, they were kind of nuts. That's right.
Good nuts.
Well, let's move forward a little bit then. Let's see. You sold your first story to DC in 2002. Tell us all about that, because that sounds really interesting.
I, through that, the JSA Appreciation Association, I had become friends with Jeff Johns, who is today the, you know, chief creative officer of DC Comics. He approached me when he was, well, like nobody, you know. He approached me because Stars and Stripe was coming out.
Right.
And I made a notation on the board about, you know, telling people, hey, here's this comic, you should, you know, you might want to look into it. It's got some connective tissue to, you know, our beloved Golden Age stuff. And he had been lurking on the group and had seen that and emailed me and said, you know, I really appreciate that. You know, I'm so excited about this comic. It was his first series, and he said, you know, I'm really hoping it'll be received well. And we started talking back and forth, and we became, you know, pretty good friends. And I had been talking to him for, boy, that was 1999. So for, you know, 2-3 years, we had talked back and forth about just the craft of writing. And I started talking to him about the Red Tornado. One of my most favorite characters is the Golden Age Red Tornado, Ma Hunkel, who wore the soup pot on her.
Right, right.
After Batman, she's my second most favorite comic book character. Oh. And by extension, I also love the Android Red Tornado.
Right.
Who of course, the Vision, you know, ripped off the Red Tornado. No. We won't get into that. But,
I know.
But I told Jeff that I had an idea. I was kept talking about the Red Tornado, you know, and I said, boy, he's so connected now in people's minds to the Justice League, when really he was introduced as into the Justice Society, you know. And I said, there really needs to be some kind of clarification on that. And, you know, I was telling him, like, hey, you ought to, you know, try to stick this into your stuff. And he's like, why don't you just do it? And I'm like, well, really? And he goes, yeah. He goes, you know, write a script, do a couple page story. They were doing those Secret Files books at that time.
Yeah.
He goes, write it up. He goes, I'll look it over and, you know, give you, you know, some pointers or whatever, and kind of help you, you know, make it to what it is. And he said, I don't know. You know, we'll see if the editor, you know, would go for it. So I don't know. Over the course of the next couple of weeks, I wrote a 3-page script. It was going to be for a 3-page story,
man.
We got it to Ivan Cohen, the then editor of the Secret Files books, and on May 4th of that year, which is my birthday, I got the call from Ivan, and he said, "We want to buy the story."
Oh man!
I was like, you know, like what, like. Oh my God. And but it got better. He goes, you know what? We want to add a page. Do you think you could do that? We want to make it a 4-page story. Like, yeah, I think I could do that. So that became a little story called Storm Chasers, which was about the Justice League and the Justice Society both came to Red Tornado and asked him to rejoin both of the teams, you know, separately. You know, they both came to him at the same time, and
right.
So, you know, and he said, he basically explained that at that point he was overseeing Young Justice, and he said, you know, this is where I should be, you know, these young heroes need my help, and this is, you know, how they should be. And there was a funny little coda where Jay Garrick, the Golden Age Flash, and Superman, who represent both groups, who were the ones that came to him, said, or Jay said to Superman, what are you thinking right now? And as they watch Red Tornado interacting with Young Justice, and Superman says, I think I want to join Young Justice. and Jay said, you and me both, pal, you and me both. I was so proud of that ending. You know,
yeah.
Those words were not changed in the slightest through the process of me learning how to write that script. That was one pure part that was, you know, still very much me.
That's very
and,
good.
So yeah, so and then after that I
I've got to say writing a 3 or even a 4-page story is so difficult. I mean, I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, people may not understand it. They may think, oh, 3 or 4 pages, well, that's easy because it's so short. But no, the shorter it is, the harder it is, because you've got to get everything that you're trying to get across in such a limited amount of space, and you don't want to have like 72 panels per page, right?
Yeah.
So I'd rather have a 100-page script where I could just take my time and fill it out than try to tell a cohesive story that makes sense, that's not rushed, that's not over-crammed. I mean, there's so many things, because my story in my Gideon Kane story in the book that just came out, the Pulp All-Star Pulp number 2, I had like 6 or 8 pages to do that, and that was extremely difficult. So I can't imagine doing 3 or 4. That's just amazing.
Yeah, it was three to begin with, and
yeah.
I can't tell you how many times, you know, Jeff said to me, you know, too much. He's the master of brevity. You know, he's like, you know, too much. You got too much going on there. You know, boil it down to the essence. Boil it down to what needs to be there and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
But Jeff, what about the this little character? No. He said, you got three characters. That's all. You know what I mean? It's like it's a conversation between three characters. Young Justice didn't even come in. They were only talked about.
Right.
Ivan came to, when he came back to me, he said, add a page where Young Justice actually shows up. He said, you know, show, don't tell. You know, we want to actually see those characters come in, so it's more impactful at the end,
right.
Reddy and Superman and Jay are talking about Young Justice, that you actually see them in the background doing what they do. And it's like, yeah, that makes complete sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I hear you. I know exactly what you mean. You know, 22 pages, oh my God, you got all the room in the world to do what you want.
I know, no kidding.
Yeah, 3 or 4 pages, oh my God.
Moving on into your further career now, you start doing books, and first you did like again, this is your career very similar to mine, except you've just done some bigger profile stuff, obviously, and I'm very envious and jealous and hate you deeply for that. But I'm just kidding.
Hey, no. If I was only prolific like you, I would be very happy.
Oh, well, that's come to a screeching halt this year, but that's neither here nor there. So Gotham City 14 Miles.
Yeah. First,
why the title? I know, but tell everybody why the title and what that's all about.
The title's twofold. That was a longstanding little joke in my family about that. At the beginning of the show, the Batmobile roars out of the Batcave and it onto the road, and the camera follows it, but then stops at the sign by the side of the road that says Gotham City 14 Miles. When the show was originally on, my sister saw that and turned to my parents and said, it's only 14 miles, why can't we go there? You know, and I love that childlike innocence, a blurring the lines, obviously, between reality and fantasy. But yeah, the childlike innocence of, it's only 14 miles, why can't we just get in the car and go there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we used to bring that up a lot through the years in my family. So I needed a title that didn't say Batman. It's funny, now I look back at it, there are unofficial, unauthorized books that actually use the word Batman. But for whatever reason, we were trying to avoid saying Batman.
Oh, I know. The same thing. It's why the two Avengers books we have are called Assembled.
Yeah, see? So I think it was more like we just didn't really want to call a lot of attention to ourselves. But I said, I got it. Gotham City, 14 Miles. And it was going to be a book of essays on the show by me and several writers. And I said, and then that obviously leads to, it's 14 miles, it's 14 essays.
Mm-hmm.
So the guys at Sequart really liked that idea, and that's what we did. So it was me and 13 other people, and we each took a different theme or topic to illustrate what that show means.
Mm-hmm.
Today. The subtitle is Why It Matters.
There you go.
It was not to be a gushing fan, you know, book. You know, I remember Julian at Sequart said it can't be a love letter.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be a critical analysis of it. But you know, readable, obviously, not dry. And I said, you know, we can do that. So we just told all the writers, like, don't go on and on about how great it is, unless you feel that way, of course. But I said, stretch out and say what you really feel like. You know, this show is not a perfect show. You know, we want the warts and all. And that's mm-hmm. what we all did. You know, we dissected it. And it really is the very first and only critical examination of that show. And I say in the introduction, you know, this book is for people who love the show, but it's also for people who hate the show. Because we wanted to show the people who love the show that there was a lot more going on in it that maybe they don't see through the rose-colored glasses. And mm-hmm. to the people who hate it, again, there's a lot more going on. You don't have to walk away loving that show, but you need to at least have some respect for the impact that it had at the time and still has today.
Just an appreciation of it, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's a perfect way of putting it. It's the same with Jack Kirby, and I've had this problem all my life. I love Jack Kirby, you know, but I can admit it. He wasn't the greatest writer in the world. But the people who hate Jack Kirby's art, that's fine. I don't really care. That's cool, and I understand it. But don't sit there and tell me that the guy had no impact.
Oh gosh.
Industry. You know, don't tell me that he's, you know, some old dude and he just needs to be forgotten. You know, it's like you can't hold up a Marvel character, barely hold up a Marvel character without tracing some sort of roots, you know, back to Kirby, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that same thing. I think of the Batman TV series and Kirby in the same way. It's, you know, love it or hate it, but you got to have some respect for it.
Absolutely. All right, let's do some quick hits through some of the other stuff, and then we'll talk about kind of what we're going on right now.
Yeah.
Sergeant Janice Spirit Breaker, what's that?
Yeah. My ode to the great Edwardian stories from people like William Hope Hodgson and his Carnacki stories, all the way to like Manly Wade Wellman, Silver John, and John Thunstone, and all those great, you know, stories from the teens, from the early part of the 20th century, all that creepy good stuff where there's a central character going around taking care of occult menaces. And I somehow stumbled onto the idea of having each story told from a different point of view. So there's eight different points of view. And boy, you know, when that hit my head, I thought, because I'm thinking, I don't want to do just a sidekick. I don't want to do third person omniscient. You know, mm-hmm. I don't want it to be first person from the guy himself. And it's like, what does that really leave? And I thought, you know, well, he's got clients. And I'm like, yeah, each one of the clients can tell the stories. And it was fun because there's eight different voices, and that was a real challenge to me.
Yeah.
And being new to prose fiction, then here I am not just doing one narrative, but eight narratives, you know, and trying to get these voices of these characters and from different walks of life and different takes on what Sergeant Janice does. And you know, people seem to like it, so I'm thrilled, and I'm at this very moment, literally, and today, I'm writing the sequel volume.
Well, I think that's a brilliant approach. I think that was a very good idea.
Thank you.
Captain Action, Real of the Glowing Man. So let me set this up. There was a Captain Action action figure, literally, in the 60s, correct?
That is correct. Almost the exact same time as the Batman TV series, 66 to 68.
Was there any other, was there any sort of media thing for him, or is it just a toy?
At the time, there was a very, very short-lived DC comic book series. It was five issues.
Okay.
All drawn by Gil Kane came in. Oh, my brain is fried at the moment, but Gil Kane came in second or third issue. Maybe he did 3, 4, 5, but the first few issues are Wally Wood.
Wow, okay.
So this has a fantastic pedigree.
Yeah.
And Jim Shooter is one of the writers on it. A young Jim Shooter wrote for this book. Just a fantastic series that's very well thought of today by the people who know about it. But again, very short lived, just like the toy itself was. And then it kind of languished. The ownership of it was kind of up in the air after Ideal went down the tubes in the 80s.
And, oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a couple different people picked it up, tried to do things with it, tried to create new comics with it. A guy named Jim Main owned it for a little while. And it was finally the Playing Mantis company finally was able to do toys again, and they did retro, you know, literally did, you know, recreated some of the sets or whatever, and then they did a few new things, and then went under. About 10 years ago or so, two guys, Joe Ahern and Ed Cato, bought Captain Action Lock, Stock, and Barrel. They own it.
Who?
Formed Captain Action Enterprises. They immediately went to putting out a new comic book series from Moonstone.
Mm-hmm.
And now today they have finally achieved the toys again, but it's not just a retread of the original toys. He's a little updated, but he's still a 12-inch action figure. And incredibly, they got the Marvel license, and they've got Spider-Man costume, Captain America costume, Thor.
Wow.
They put Dr. Evil out again, and they've just announced that they have the DC license now. And cross my fingers, it looks like they might even have the Batman 66 license.
Wow.
So they're going great guns on it. Ed, in particular, is a huge Pulp fan, and mm-hmm. he's had me sit on Pulp panels at comic book shows before. And I've talked to these guys on and off about, get me into writing the comics. Yeah, I want to do something with Captain Action. And finally, I pitched the idea of them to do a Pulp novel. In fact, I said we should do a whole Pulp magazine and do it just like as if it came out in the 40s or maybe even the 60s, you know, and everything. And they were like, yeah, it's interesting or whatever. And then out of the blue, a couple months later, they got back to me and said, you know what? We do want to do that. Let's do that. And I said, okay, I know just the publisher. Got Ron and Rob at Airship 27 on board, and within 24 hours through email and then through a phone conversation that they all had, they sealed the deal. I mean, literally, it was like wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
And so today we have one of the very first, you know, licensed characters in New Pulp.
In New Pulp, that's right.
In New Pulp. And I didn't know, you know, how it would work or if it would work at all, you know, or if it was just too far afield. And I mean, it, again, just like Sergeant Janice, people seem to like it. I look at that book today and I don't know how it came up out of me. You know what I mean? It's like, if you had told the 10-year-old me that I'd be writing a like spy thriller, you know, a pulpy thing like that with Captain Action, I probably would have said, you know, you got to be crazy. You know? But Ed Cato, I love it. He came up with this one phrase for it, and I love it, and I use this to try to sell it to people. He said, it's, what if Ian Fleming wrote a Doc Savage novel? And I can't come up with a better description for that. I just think that's the greatest thing, and it's like, wow, I said...
that's a pretty cool description.
I know, I said, you know, you couldn't have honored me more, you know, I mean, oh my God, you know, comparing that to Ian Fleming and to Lester Dent, that's
pretty awesome.
So now what do I have to do? I have to write book two, and it's like, how the hell am I ever going to top that? So I'm not going to try, I'm just going to write the damn thing, and that's actually this week, I will start writing book two. Of that.
Well,
and
there we go.
Should be a trilogy once it's all said and done.
Very good. So you got a couple of new things coming along that are from their sequels to your first big triumphs.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, you got to tell us a little bit about Monster Earth real quick. We only got a few minutes left, but we got to
get
Monster Earth.
Monster Earth is from Mechanoid Press and the amazing, fantastic James Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
We put our heads together. We, on the Pulp Factory Yahoo group, we both expressed an interest in combining the idea of giant monsters like Godzilla with pulp-style writing. And again, I go back to that word. It was like wildfire. We put our heads together. We, you know, created a Bible. I had this idea about an alternate history of the 20th century where every country has their own giant monsters, just like they would have nuclear weapons. And we went from there and got an incredible group of writers together and created this really fun, you know, book with giant monsters and a couple of humans in there too.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be heading down that path again. And I think that there's a new writer coming into Volume 2. You may know him. His name is very similar to yours.
Yeah, it's possible. I'm certainly thinking it over, and I'm certainly honored to be asked. That's really neat. It's a brilliant idea. I was a big fan of the. I've never liked the movies that much, but I was a huge fan of the Marvel Godzilla comic and the Shogun Warriors comics.
Shogun Warriors! Oh, I didn't think anybody remembered that.
That was the only Marvel series I ever had every issue of from beginning to end. You know, because it got canceled on like number 20. Was it 20 or 12? Somewhere in there. It made it a good run of about a year or two. And then they...
Right.
I read that thing to death, backwards and forwards. I could tell you the entire story from start to finish. Dr. Demonicus and the aliens at the end. And the I loved it. I loved it. Let me
Fantastic.
See.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
The Pacific Rim is ripping us off. The new Pacific Rim movie is ripping us off.
Yeah. Well, maybe it'll work back the other way, though, and give some...
Yeah.
Give us the other way.
We hope so.
Well, let's see. Lastly, you got to tell me what else you're working on right now. That I guess we kind of touched on this a little bit. That you're working on another Sergeant Janus book, which is
Would
you describe that sort of supernatural thriller kind of? How is that?
You know, I mean, it's basically ghost stories. You know, with a guy who goes around and breaks spirits. He busts ghosts. And
Sergeant Janus Ghostbuster probably didn't have the same ring to it. Who are you gonna get on your?
Who are you gonna call? Well, your lawyer for one. book two is different again. I won't spoil it for anybody, but something big kind of happens to Sergeant Janus at the end of the first book. And there's a little journey in there for him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's different yet again. I'm starting to work on Captain Action Book 2, and I'm also working on a Shudder pulp invention of my own, and it's kind of combining the idea of a villain pulp with the great tradition of the Shudder or horror pulps. I just wrote a 12,000 word prelude, and then there's which will hopefully whet people's appetites for the full novel. That's going to be coming out from Prose, hopefully this year.
So when you say Shudder pulp, give us an example of something that we might know about that would be.
I'm trying
Lovecraft
to think
or what?
Yeah, in a way, but maybe a little more, you know, pulpy than that.
Okay.
I'm thinking of, I think the guy's name was Hugh Cave, wrote a lot of those things. There was very little, like, series in those. It was mostly, you know, standalone stories. But the more horror end of pulp in that, but then also again mixing in this idea with the villain. Are you familiar with I'm stupid to even say this, but you know the octopus and the scorpion? That's what I'm mostly inspired by, especially the octopus. You know, those wonderful one issue pulp magazines that the central character basically is a villain. I'm obsessed with the idea of comics or books being focused on villains, and it's never truly worked.
Yeah.
And it's something that I've wanted to play with for a while because I love the octopus. The scorpion's pretty good too, but I love the octopus pulp. That's
wasn't there a Dr. Satan? Did he have his own?
Yes. Yeah, Dr. Satan was a backup series in Weird Tales, if I'm not mistaken. And then there was also the Oriental villain. There was two of them.
That's just the best name, because you got to think if you're Dr. Satan.
Yeah.
You can't really go into the medical practice because nobody's going to come see you. You know, nobody's going to come see you. And so
there's the pulp hero called Captain Satan.
Oh, that's even better. But I'm thinking Dr. Satan, nobody's going to come to your office for a checkup or anything, so you might as well like do evil schemes, right? Otherwise you're going to go hungry. Nobody's going to come give you business. So, all right, well, anyway.
You have no choice but to become a villain, right?
Exactly. You're pretty much trapped at that point. So,
but yeah, if someone wants to get an idea of what I'm trying to do, look to... the octopus. That's what I'm trying to
look
do.
Look to the octopus. That's always good advice, is look to the octopus.
Yeah.
When the
damn,
squid,
I gotta use that title.
when the squid needs advice, I always say look to the octopus. and you're also doing a story, I think, for a certain sort of Native American related book.
Yes. Again, if you went back in time and told my 10-year-old self that one day you would be writing a story based on Last of the Mohicans, number one, I probably would have said, "What's Last of the Mohicans?" at 10 years old. But not just Last of the Mohicans, but the 1992?
Yeah, I think it's
1992 film of Last of the Mohicans.
The Michael Mann 1992 film.
Yeah, with Oscar Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis heading up the cast as Hawkeye. Love the movie. My wife's a huge fan of that movie, and she got me, you know, hooked on it.
Yeah.
And really excited because, some really great historical research that I have to do on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started doing it, you know, and looking into that era and how fascinating it is. So this is going to be a huge challenge for me,
because
mm-hmm. I've never really written something like that so historical. But the visuals from that movie are going to prove to be a great inspiration.
Right.
And I'm really looking forward to that, and very honored to be included in that volume.
I think you're exactly right. It is it's a beautiful movie. Wouldn't you think if Michael Mann made a Last of Mohicans movie, there should be a scene at some point where Hawkeye is cruising along through the woods in his Ferrari while Phil Collins' music plays or something? But
that was in the sequel that never got made. I think. Yeah.
Mohican Vice.
Mohican Vice. You just got your title.
Kentucky
your title
Vice.
Right there. Yeah. The heck with the ones that I suggested. That's it right there.
Kentucky Vice.
Oh, you're gonna.
Oh Lord.
You're gonna sell a million with that.
Oh
one.
Boy. All right. Well, we're nearly out of time. What have you got coming up in terms of shows, conventions where people can see you or whatever?
Yeah, at least two more things this year. We got Pulp Fest coming up, which for the very first time I'm doing a reading, and it may be the very last time too. But I'm going to do a signing at the Airship 27 table. This is all on Saturday. I'll be there on Saturday. Signing at the Airship 27 table on the panel, the Pulp panel, and then doing a reading, and I'm going to read from Sergeant Janice and Captain Action, and a little bit from Monster Earth. Really, I guess I'm excited about that. And then I'm also going to be, in October, I'm going to be at Detroit Fan Fair.
Oh, okay.
But it's not actually in Detroit. It's in, I think it's, now I can't think of it. It's in Flint. Or, no, it's in Dearborn. What am I saying? It's in Dearborn, Michigan, although it's called Detroit Fan Fair.
Mm-hmm.
And I urge everybody listening to this to please come out to this, because I'm going to be the lone pulp guy in the middle of all these comic book people. please come out. It's a challenge for us pulp guys at comic book shows.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we got to get you down to some southern, midwestern and southern shows.
I know.
Shows too,
well, hopefully Pulp Arc next year. It just hasn't been in the cards yet. And, you know, damn me anyways, but here I won the award for the new best new pulp writer, and
new writer,
I was
there
to be able to accept it. So
yeah, there you go.
That's a goal for next year. Got to get down there. I got to meet Tommy face to face.
Are you sure you have to meet Tommy face to face? I kid, Tommy. All right. Well, we were just about out of time now, but I want to thank Jim Beard for coming on today and talking about all this fun stuff. And tell the folks one more time where they can find you on the internet. That's the easiest way.
Yeah, on Facebook at my quote-unquote fan page. I hate calling it that.
I know what you mean.
The Jim Beard fan page. that would be a fantastic place to find me. And then also at the Sergeant Janice Spirit blog, which is SGTJANUS dot. Help me out here. You have it in front of you. I don't. It's Blogspot.
Yeah.
.com.
SergeantJanice.blogspot.com. I had to switch over to a different window. Sorry.
That's it. All right. So those would be the best places to find me.
There we go. All right. Well, it's about time for the rocket to get on out of here for another episode. Our time is up. As always, we thank you for yours, and we will see you guys down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.